Okay, we can get started.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Jay. Thanks, everybody, for participating. We have today a special challenge with the shiur.
Okay.
Hold on.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
That is the outline of the lecture of the shiur. And I actually want to start with the biblical text. We say in the Haftarah of Hanukkah, text from the prophet Zechariah. Mm-hmm. Which is a beautiful text, has a beautiful description of his vision. It's a dream, a night vision, a prophecy at night, together with six other visions. And it's part of this beautiful menorah, which is the symbol of the state of Israel. I want to start there with the Haftarah, which will take us to another general question. How are the 12 prophets related? I want to show they are related. I focus on contextuality. So since that is my special favorite aspect, I would like to show you that the 12 prophets, they have a wonderful interaction together. I will not show that on the entire field, of course, 12 prophets, but on Haggai and Zechariah, which were the spiritual leaders at the time of the return to Zion, Shivat Zion. And I want to show you by a very creative interpretation that Hanukkah goes back to a very, very early stage, actually much earlier than when it happened, the Nevi'im, the prophets, spoke about it. And that's quite a fascinating insight, which we'll address. In the view, in the night vision of Zechariah, he sees two people, the priest, the high priest, Yehoshua ben Yehotzadak, and Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel, a leader who brought the Jewish people back. And I want to show why they were in the center of this vision. And we will talk about Zechariah's night visions, which are a beautiful structure in the shape of a menorah. And that is what I want to show. You will see it goes from different topic. It's a lot of material. And I cannot go in depth of all the material, but I want to give a certain taste. And the best part in my shiur, I can say that for sure, is if you go afterwards home and open the books and read, and you see whether it's true or not, that's the best part. Even if it's not true, what I say, but if you learn it and you make up your mind, that is the best part. I hope actually that we will see some issues at least, which are stimulating, and you will see some new, very special insights, which I hope to present now. It's a lot of material that I'm trying to show, but I want to show like a continuous point, which goes from one to the other, and I will summarize it at the end. That is the entire Bible in my Hebrew diagram in one slide. And that is Jewish chutzpah, because how can you take one slide and put everything there? But what I want to show is a very important point. The 12 prophets are taken as one book, Treasar, and the earliest one, Hoshea, is at the end of the kingdom of Israel, before 722, before the common era. The last three are after the return, at the time of the return from the exile from Babylon. So it is a continuum of more than 200 years. And it's a continuum which starts at the time of the first temple and goes on to the time of the second temple. So it's a very special, it's a long night. It's a very long night of destruction, of diaspora, of death, of the worst developments in Jewish history. And they come back to Zion from Babylon, from the river of Babylon at Al-Naharot Babel, Psalm 137. They come back and build up Eretz Yisrael at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. Here, this overlap or this continuum from... Hello, here. This continuum is in itself very, very interesting. And here we will focus not only on the continuum of the older Treasar, the 12th, I want to focus on Zechariah. And he connects to many others. So if you think that I'm the first who tries to connect all the books I have to tell you, there was a much more creative Talmid Chacham at the time of the Gemara. Of course, in the Yerushalmi and in the Midrash, a source of Eretz Yisrael, where it says, Ben Azai haya yoshev v'doresh. When Ben Azai was teaching and explaining, giving his explanations, Ha'esh melahetet svibotav. There was a fire in the room. Can you imagine? He teaches and there is fire. And people came and asked him, tell me, Shema besidrei merkavata osek? Are you teaching philosophical aspects, mystical aspects? And he says, no. Lav ela machriz divrei Torah lenevi'im. ונביאים לכתובים ודברי תורה שמחים כיום לתינותם בסיני. By stringing together, connecting the words of the Torah to those of the prophets, and these words to the words of the ketuvim, and these to the words of the Torah. And they were as happy as they were at the day that they were given on Sinai. So that is, in one word, intertextuality. He connects different books. How is he doing that? What's the message? We don't know how Ben Azai did that. And I'm very curious to understand better what was in his mind. But I want to show that that's the way to look at the Bible. We are not learning Zechariah. We learn the Bible. And we focus today on Zechariah and his time and other prophets which are part of the collection. If we look only at one book, we lose the context. So that's what I want to show you. And this Midrash is wonderful because modern research and biblical scholarship and the literature at large tries to connect different themes from different books, from different authors. And that is exactly what the Midrash says. That's the way it was given at Sinai. Oh, at Sinai, the Ketuvim and Nevi'im, they were not written yet. Doesn't matter, for the Midrash all is connected. So here I want to show you why it's very difficult to do that, and I called it good reasons why not to show the next slides. So if I'm going to show them, I'm losing it. I will lose the audience. But I have to explain it or to apologize why it is a big challenge, and that needs scholarship of years to find that out. We don't generally learn the 12 minor prophets as a unit. So if somebody is familiar with Amos, with Micha, with another prophet, he knows his field and he wrote, he was teaching or writing or learning it. So he has one field, but people don't look at them at the large. So there are not a lot of experts who know it. It's a big, big unit, too much information. 67 chapters is bigger than Yeshayahu. The next book, which where we have to learn all the context, is, of course, Tehillim, 150 Mizmorim. It's a huge challenge. It works perfectly. And why to consider to take totally different periods of Jewish history before the destruction and after the destruction and at the time of Shivat Zion, the return to Zion, all together? How can that be connected? There are 12 personalities, 12 thinkers. Why all of a sudden to take that as a unit? And that is, of course, a good question. And people didn't look at it as a unit. I want to show you how it works. It's a big challenge. Here we have the 12 names with the numbers of their chapters. It's 67. And I should add here at what time they were giving their prophecies. The last one, Haggai, Zechariah and Malachi, were after the return to Zion. The first one, Hoshea, Yoel, Amos, were at the time when the Jewish state of Kingdom of Israel was still around, before 722. And afterwards, in between. We don't know all the times exactly. So how to put it all together? That seems to be, at the first impression, it seems to be not to the point. But I want to show you how much it is to the point. And here I have two books. I try not to show books which I haven't read. So here I can prove you that I read them. You see here the two books. And they show that reading and hearing the book of the 12 as a unit. Nogalski is one of the authors who researched the field very carefully in the second book as well. and they want to show that the juxtaposing views on interpreting the Book of the 12 as a unit is a very new, fascinating field of research. Mazel tov, very happy for you that you found that. I want to show you now that this beautiful research, which I admire and congratulate them for that, and the Midrash has it, but I want to show it that if you have a careful reading of the Gemara, it's exactly in the text, but most beautifully in the text. And I come to the Gemara in Baba Batra. There is a Gemara which explains the source and the sequence of all the books of the Bible, and the stage of the canon when they were codified. And there it says that there is a special halacha. Bein chumash lechumash shel Torah, arba'a shittim. V'chein bein kol navi lenavi. Uven navi shel shneimasar, gimel shittim. The Gemara says, you have it here from Schottenstein, that when different books are included in the same scroll, the bold text is the translation, four empty lines of space should be left between each book of the Torah. It means between Bereshit and Shmot, it's one big scroll, but we make a break, a little break in between, and in the empty space, you leave there just four empty lines. Why? Because each book of the Torah has its own life, has a whole structure. They are part of it all together, but you keep it together, but you also keep it independently. The same is true, ben kol navi le navi. And similarly, between one book of the prophets and another, between Yeshayahu, Yirmiyahu, don't mix them together. You want to put them in one scroll, vakasha, you can do that. But that's a unit and that's a unit. And here we have a text where it says, uvenavi shel shneimasar gimel shittim. So Rabbi Jay, you are the rabbinical judge here in the audience, and everybody can participate. Schottenstein has to explain it, bein uvenavi, in the prophet of the 12, three. Schottenstein had a hard time to translate, so he translated, but between each of the books of the 12, only three empty lines should be left, because they are considered one book. But the translation between each of the books of the 12 is not the proper translation. I deleted it, and I added, but in the prophet of the 12th, only three empty lines. That is exactly the translation, Ubenavi shel shneimasar gimel shittim. Not four lines, only three. That is a halacha. That's the way these books are written. And if you pay attention to the halacha, how the sofer has to write the books, and we keep in mind what the research says, it is just the same. The modern research found out what the Gemara says in six words. Ubenavi shel shneimasar gimel shittim. That's not proper Hebrew, and therefore Schottenstein made a correction. That's not a good approach, because the Gemara didn't talk a non-appropriate Hebrew. The Gemara was very sharp. There is one prophet which is composed of 12 prophets. There is one spirit and one mind which takes us from Hosea to the very, very end of the little 12 prophets. And that is exactly, precisely the wording. Ubenavi shel shneimasar gimel shittim. That is to me quite surprising and fascinating, because I enjoy the research, but I enjoy to come back to the Gemara and to the Beit Midrash and to the Yeshiva, and to recognize, wow, that's exactly what it says. Please don't correct it. Just try to understand. Rashi has a good explanation that why it happened that they were all together and it came to the end of the Ruach HaKodesh, since they were the last prophets. So they wrote all the prophecies and combined them as one unit. And he is more technical. The books shouldn't get lost. I think there is much more into it, what Rashi says. And one of the non-accepted books in the biblical canon, Ben Sira, people say you shouldn't read it, but the Gemara actually quotes, Ben Sira. So I put it not on black and white. You shouldn't blame me on my slides. I put it in gray. In Ben Sira, it says that even the 12 prophets, their bones will yet bloom in the tomb and their memory will be for a blessing. Why? Because they comforted the house of Yaakov and told them about their Yeshua. So it is the 12. It's a unit of the 12 prophets, Am Yisrael, the 12 tribes. So we will now explain that. That is the wonderful sheet, which is the killer.
Benny, can I enter? Can you make it a little bigger on the screen, just so it's a little bit? I mean, it'll be a touch easier to read.
Yes. Good. So it's actually impossible to read.
Yeah, it's impossible. But even if the other sheets are a little bit bigger, it wouldn't hurt. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now it's bigger. Good.
So what I show here, it's an A3 format, double.
You can read this. It's actually, I mean, it's not easy, but it's legible actually now.
I'm happy to hear that because when I come when I give a shiur here in Alon Shvut, they say, oh, Gesundheit again with your handouts. They call it actually not handouts anymore. They call it the arm outs.
Where do you photocopy it? Where do you do in Toronto? I forget now. Where
The Kinko's. So look at here. Here we have a motif, which I took from all the 12 books, and that's actually published here. And it says here, certain motifs of the Yom Hashem, the day of the Lord Hashem. At the beginning, it is a tough punishment. At the end, it's a lot of love. It's the same word which goes through. I cannot elaborate it here. At the beginning, at the time of Hoshea, Yoel and Amos, Hashem says, and Yonah, as an example in a non-Jewish population, make tshuva and come back. But the Jewish people didn't. And the encouragement is make tshuva, engage in tshuva, and God will forgive you. At the end, it says the same wording, but not shuvu el Hashem. It says shuvu elai. God is talking, and I will come back to you. It's like after a period that in a relationship there was a disconnect. At the end, no mediator in between, no prophets. It is Hashem who is speaking. Shuvu elai v'ashuva alechem. I promise you, if you make tshuva, I'm waiting for you. The door is open. You will run into an open door. That is the beauty if we read it all together. And there's a whole line. I would actually like to show it on Zechariah, Haggai and Zechariah, which are particularly connected, same time. And there are a lot of connections, but I cannot elaborate this sheet, which has fascinating. All the analogies which you see here appear in the entire Bible, if they're on the red background, only here. So there is a scientific proof, that's what I think, that these books are connected. I want to show you now how it works in a different context. And that is particularly Haggai and Zechariah. They're not together because it happened. There is a strong reason for that. When the Jewish people came back from Babylon, that was a big, big challenge socially, politically, economically. There was a whole challenge. How can they leave Babylon and come to Eretz Israel? And it's a fascinating period. We had the same in our days. Shivat Zion. The period is called the time of Shivat Zion. Of course, the text, which appears only in Tehillim 126, Tehillim summarizes that. How do you bring a nation back from the exile to Eretz Yisrael? Not an easy task. It wasn't easy in the beginning of the 20th century. In the middle, it's very complex and a very painful process to make such a thing happen. And there were two leaders of the time of Shivat Zion, which are Haggai and Zechariah. And it says in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, where the story is, this chapter of Jewish history is elaborated, presented. In those years, Haggai the prophet and Zechariah, son of Iddo, both prophets, and they brought the Jewish people back. And that was at the time when Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Yehoshua, the son of Yotzadak, they began to build the house of God. And you can see that they even don't talk Hebrew. In the translation, it's not expressed. They talk in the Bible, Aramaic. Sefer Daniel is part of it in Aramaic. They don't Yiddish. Meret v'in d'haim. It's not the modern language. They don't talk Hebrew. Oh, they will talk about it, about the new language and not assimilation with other languages, but it's very authentic that the Aramaic language reflects their really gulis. They come really from the diaspora. They even don't know Hebrew. So these two prophets, they appear together. Haggai and Zechariah. I want to encourage you, if you want to understand the idea of the 12, start with wherever you feel you want to start. If you read Haggai and Zechariah, the same dates, the same name of the king, the second year, the second year, and the second year, and the second year, and the fourth year. It's one continuum, and many themes, of course, they share. So who was Zerubbabel, the leader, and Yehoshua, son of Yotzadak, the leader? And here I would like to show you that these two figures, which are quoted very often in Haggai and in Zechariah, that's exactly what it says in the historical book Ezra, that they were quoted as the leaders of the return. The Zerubbabel and Yotzadak are mentioned there as the two leaders. Who were these people? And here we have, I think, a fascinating insight, which is most relevant for our generation, but gives a very good explanation on the time of return of Zion, Shivat Zion, and to our days. As we say in the Bracha, Hanukkah bayamim hahem bazman hazeh, in these days and to that time. And here we have Yehoshua ben Yehotzadak. He is the high priest. I had a hard time to squeeze everything in, so I just covered it with a little bit of English, but I can take it off. And if you want to see the sources and read Hebrew, you will find it all. Yehoshua ben Yehotzadak, the son of Yehotzadak, he was the high priest. He came back from Babylon and was in charge. He was the son of Yehotzadak. And he was sent from Jerusalem to Babylon. He lived in Jerusalem, but he was sent there at the time of the destruction of the temple when the Jewish people left Eretz Israel. He had big scars on his body from whatever happened during the Galut. And he was the son, Yehotzadak, of Sraya Kohen Harosh. The Kohen Agadol is called Sraya, the high priest. And there is a terrible description. Nebuzardan, the representative of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar sent Nebuzardan, and he brought the whole presentation of the Jewish population in Jerusalem after he killed them and destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. He brought them all to Rivla. And the king wanted to see them face to face in order to celebrate their execution in front of him. So Sraya was the last priest of Eretz Yisrael who was killed. He was brought to the king of Babylon in order to kill him publicly. Execution. Yehotzadak was his son. Oh, they had scars. They were second generation survivors. Whatever happened with them, I'm not aware of this big research they had on the second generation, but you don't need to give more explanation on that. The brother of Yehotzadak, Yehoshua ben Yehotzadak's father, he was also a priest. His name was Ezra, and he is the famous Ezra and Nehemiah. The people who came back had deep sources in Eretz Yisrael with the Beit Mikdash, with the temple, because their father was the last high priest. And they came back, they did not give up. Interesting enough that Yehoshua ben Yehotzadak, his son is Yoyakim, which is named after the second last king of Yehuda before the exile. And he was actually the first one who was a victim of Babel, of the king of Babylon. So you can tell from these very, very general notes on their personality that they had deep sources to Eretz Yisrael, terrible traumatic experiences in the exile, but when there was an option to come back, they were the first to come back. And I want to summarize that this transition is a major mental shift from destruction to Eretz Yisrael. And that is a remarkable phenomenon. If we look at the pictures from survivors of the camps who came to Eretz Yisrael, these are the people who started again. And the little child who you can see here is nobody else than the chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael, Rav Leshavar, the chief rabbi of Rav Yisrael Meir Lau, who came from Buchenwald and came back. These were the people who built again. That is true for Sraya, the king, one of them. And the other one is Zerubbabel ben Shaaltiel. Shaaltiel heißt, I was asking for God. That's the name, the meaning of the name. Zerubbabel, Zeru, is expelled to Babel. His name says it all. And there are interesting aspects of the name, which we will see more shortly. It's not totally clear. There is a machloket to understand who was the father. Might be the uncle, the grandfather, but he was the son of Shaaltiel. And he was born in captivity. He was born in jail. It says in one of the psukim, Uvnei Yechonia Asir Shaaltiel beno. Asir means he was born in jail. Asirei Tzion are the refuseniks. The Hebrew term of the refuseniks is Asir Tzion. It's unbelievable how relevant the analogies are. So his father of Zerubbabel, he was born in jail. His grandfather, Jehoiachin, he was the last king of Yehuda. And he was captured in Babylon and lived for many, many, many years in jail. At the end, the king of Babylon, after the end of his life, he let him out and gave him a little bit more bread. That's it. What deep scars did these two personalities have from the memory of the good old days of Jehoiakim, the last king of Yehuda, the second last, and Jehoiachin, Shaaltiel, born in captivity in jail, and Zerubbabel comes back. What energies they brought from the destruction. And the same picture here again. One is the king and the other one is the high priest. And they together, and now we understand a lot on this history, they together turned the disaster of the diaspora and the destruction in a new area of rebuilding, return, and thriving in Eretz Yisrael. Quite a lot of challenges to face, but they did it. So we have the king and the priest together. And you will see shortly, we should see, that they appear as one unit in the prophecy of Zechariah. They are together. It is like two people who work together, a philosopher king, or in this example, not the philosopher king of classical Greek, the state. It is the Jewish version. It is the philosopher king. It is the priest who is teaching Torah, who is fully involved in religious activities in the temple and to teach others. Together with the king, they are one unit. Two people mentioned almost all the time together. This combination is found in a wonderful commentary, which I read. I will show it to you in a moment. Is shown by a wonderful, excellent Swiss researcher, Otmar Kehl. Worthwhile to Google him and to see his pictures. He has a collection of, when I met him many years ago, he told me more than 40,000 items, historical items, and he published them. And look what he sees here. He sees here that the king to heaven, the gate to heaven, at the time of Shivat Zion, the gate to heaven That's a personality which takes one to heaven. And there is a gate here. And left and right are two famous people, also with a kind of a crown. And a tree on this side and on this side, he says, it's olive. I can't assess it. And they bring and support the gate to heaven. That is the background of Shivat Zion. That is the cultural background, religious background. Now we should see that and learn a little bit more about meaning of Hanukkah and this time of the return. Since I brought a lot of non-Jewish scholars and archaeology, one might get nervous. Let me bring you a fascinating rabbi, a classical, wonderful scholar, Reb Yaakov Emden. And he says what is mentioned by Rashi, Ibn Ezra, Radak, but he says it more explicitly. The time of Haggai and Zechariah, that there is a kingdom, and the kingdom is very, very bad for the Jews, and at the end they will be liberated from this kingdom. And they say it might be the time of the Hashmonaim. But if you learn Jewish history, we are not yet there at the time of the Hashmonaim. But Rashi Ibn Ezra and Radak are very clear about it. I brought here all the sources which I found, and it's very clear that they talk in Haggai, Zechariah, a little bit later in Zechariah as well, that they see the Hashmonaim coming up. But Rav Yaakov Emden, in his fascinating responsa, elaborates this idea, and I didn't translate the text. He says, Hanukkah, I think I have a very interesting innovation to tell you here, he says. It is called Hanukkah because the Hechal, the temple, sanctuary, at the time of Haggai and Zechariah, as we learn in Haggai, was built the day the 24th of the 9 months, which is the month of Kislev. That is what it says in the biblical text. At the 24th, it was started. But if you start the day that the sanctuary of the Lord was founded, was first established, there is a day afterwards. That's just the eve of. So he wants to say the beginning was we should build more and more and more. It's the darkest day or the darkest period in the four seasons. It's very much in the winter. So afterwards, there is more light. There is a Gemara, Masechet Avodah Zarah, which he shows later. So he says, the day of the 24th of Kislev is the eve of Hanukkah. We want to continue that. And if the Hashmonaim, 100 years later, were successful, they took the motif of the biblical vision. The night will end, and there will be a morning. It's just the day afterwards. That is his take, which is extremely creative. Rav Yoel Binun and Rav Shai Zevin earlier elaborated this idea. And that is really interesting. So we are here not to discuss what happened at the time of the Hashmonaim. We are pre-Hashmonaim. Because at the time when they came back from the exile in Babylon, they had a hard time to build it up. It wasn't easy. It wasn't straightforward at all. But the desire was, let's build it and let's be successful. One of the milestones in this history happened years, decades down the road when the Hashmonaim saved the Jewish state from the destruction. They were at risk that their efforts of Ezra and Nehemiah, Haggai and Zechariah should fail, Chas v'Shalom. So the Hashmonaim just added one day later. We continue. 8 days? Why 8 days? Because after these 8 days, the days start to be longer. And nature, the sun tells you, oh, we crossed the difficult night and now we start daytime. That is a very, very interesting insight, very creative. And I'm not sure if that is really the source of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is in the books of the Maccabean, but that is like a very, very early source, pre-Maccabean, that they might have this date in mind when they established that. So that was the rabbinical part. And now I take you, and here, Ruth, I would like to ask you to read in a moment. And I read the German scholars with great enthusiasm. And what I'm going to show you now, I couldn't find. I tried to read carefully the Mefarshim, which we have, and I try to read very, very carefully Jewish scholars and religious scholars and Midrashim. And I find something in the, I find approaches in the research, American, a lot of German researchers, wonderful, amazing researchers with a long-standing tradition. And they can elaborate messages in the text, which I have not found in the classical Jewish sources. And I would like to show you here an amazing source from Rav Soloveitchik, where he talks how impressed he is when he learns from non-Jewish scholars. Ruth, if you could please read it, I'll appreciate it.
On the relevance of the Bible, it is especially important to see the Bible as a mirror in which the human destiny in general, and the Jewish one in particular, is reflected, and thus to discern the most correct course of action to take. The story of the Bible always has a double meaning, or a truth with two different aspects, a record of events that occurred in reality, and the eternal significance of these events. They symbolize human destiny and encompass all of thousands of years. Unfortunately, the modern Jew lacks this kind of sensitivity. He does not respond to the beauty and majesty of the Bible. We read mechanically the words addressed to us by the ancient sages who were God's messengers and whose teachings were in their mouths. We treat these words as if they are not meaningful to us. I often feel jealous of the non-Jew who shows such an understanding of the biblical word. This is from Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, his Festival of Freedom, Essays on Pesach and the Haggadah. From Otsar.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I often feel jealous of the non-Jews who show such an understanding of the Bible. So I read what I'm going to present you now. I mean, that's an amazing scholar. His PhD in Berlin, and he learned in Brisk of the top scholars. And he's open to learn from others. So these are the two of the German scholars on Zechariah, some 800 pages on 8 chapters, and the master, Erich Zengel, who has beautiful insights. And that goes back to a publication which goes back to 1973, where he quotes an earlier one from 1945. And here another handout, which is a killer. Rabbi Jay, two such killers in one lecture is too much.
See if you can enlarge it, and maybe we can also read it a little bit. It worked the other time. I could read it, you know. So
I will try to show it now. But I want to show you. I will translate it in a moment to the English summary. Sorry, the English summary. But what I want you to see here. That's the biggest I can show here. What I did here, I took the 7 prophecies, the night visions, which happened all during the same night, and I put them together. Oh, they put it together. They didn't have PowerPoint, these scholars. And we have number 1, 2, 3. We have in the middle a prophecy on Yoshua HaKohen and Sha'altiel. Here is the menorah. And at the end, we have 3, 2, 1. And there is an analogy between 1 and 7. I called it 1 asterisk between 2, 3, and that is the axis in between. And I proved that by simple text, by simple rules. If a text appears only in the entire Bible in this section here, in the upper section 1, and in the section at the end, it seems they correspond. They use the same words. And they appear as a frame. And you have here a frame, an external frame, 1 to 7, and a frame between 2, 3 and 5, 6. And we have in the middle a central piece. Yes, it's double because Yoshua and Zerubbabel are double. What is the message of these 7 night visions? And that's a masterful piece of biblical poetry. I want to show it here, and we'll come back in a moment to the text we had before. Hold on. That's the flow. It goes from right to left. I took the what you saw here at the right margin. I turned it by 90 degree and put it here. It is shaped as a menorah. 1, 2, 3, the axis, 3, 2, 1. What happened in between? At the beginning, we have white and red horses, which will walk through the land, but the land is quiet. Nothing happens. God has compassion to build Jerusalem. At the very, very end of Haggai, just the lines before the beginning of Zechariah, Haggai says, the colleague of Zechariah, God will send his horses to the entire world. And it's known that the Persian horses were famous for their efficacy. Fast, efficient, and very, very good communication. These days, no WhatsApp, of course, no websites, but they can bring message to the entire world. But nothing happens. Va'aretz shketa. At the end, it says that these red and white horses, they have chariots and they will go all over. And they were bringing the exiled from Babylonia to build God's sanctuary in Yerushalayim. What was passive here gets activated here. And here we have an external condition of Jerusalem in a negative and positive sense. Please read it, and you can take this handout as a guide. Even if you read it in English, it's very helpful. Just put it together, find the words, and it works perfectly. Vision number 2 is the removal of the dangers from the Gentiles. The bad nations will be punished. The third vision is that it will be the building of the city of Yerushalayim. It will be built and be a huge city for all nations and for God. Can you imagine the spiritual message? They come back from the exile, Yehoshua and Zerubbabel, with all the scars in their family of the terrible experience of the diaspora, of the destruction of the temple. But they want Jerusalem to be a land, a city for all nations. And they say in chapter 2:16, Yerushalayim will invite all the nations, and with all the nations together, they will be the Jewish people. It's the classical shift from the national background, national historical background, to the universal international attitude. We were in the diaspora in order to open the gates of Jerusalem, which were destroyed by Babylon. But now they are open gates for all nations. A fascinating message without the beautiful structure. But it has the message, it's open for everybody. In the beginning, Yehoshua and Zerubbabel are chosen. And there is the parable of the menorah with 2 olive trees or branches. And they are the eyes of God. The olive has oil. It's the symbol of the menorah. Babel is the symbol of darkness. B'machashakim hoshivani Hashem. I was sent, says Eicha, the lemons. I was in darkness in the Galut. But now they come back. But the darkness from Babel, the response to the darkness is not as in Babel or in Persia, which you see in the picture, a mystical way to heaven with a lot of idolatry. No. It is coming back. The real gate to heaven is come back to Jerusalem with Zerubbabel and with Yehoshua. That's the real light of the world. Not their symbols and ritual thoughts. It's translated. That's the message of Otmar Kehl. And afterwards, there is not only an external condition of Jerusalem, there are internal conditions. The sins, the purification of the city from evil. And the evil goes back to Yerushalayim. Uva letzion goel ulashavei fesha. When you start to rebuild Jerusalem, we start a new chapter. We forget or we fix, we try to overcome all the mistakes of the past. So 2:3 corresponds to 3:2. And at the end, when there was no message at the beginning, the land was quiet. Now the land is not quiet. Chariots will go all over. Merkava, The same words here and there. The same words, Merkava. It's the Merkava of Yechezkel, which was brought to the Galut. And now they come back. The Merkava comes back from Babel to Eretz Israel. That is a beautiful message. Now, I don't have a chance, and it's not the task of our interpretation, to take night visions, which are dreams, and to put them in a geometrical order. So not every word is ABC, X, CBA, but the structure is clearly structured as a menorah. And that's what we see here. In the middle is the Kohen and the king together. And if you read the two visions in the middle, there are two units which are combined like that. A lot of words are connected. Why? Because the text actually brings a reality, brings the reality, the political reality, the philosophical, the prophetic reality, the vision of the eschatology of Mashiach, puts it in the structure of the text. King David and the priest come back. The king, who has a big, big respect for the Mikdash, and the Mikdash with a great respect for the kingship, it comes together. And if that is overcome, that nothing happens in the world, and Jerusalem has to be rebuilt, once that happened, the rebuilding of Jerusalem will actually clarify it for the entire world and will bring the message to the entire world with the Merkava. That is an amazing structure. I show it here again with this animation, the horses at the beginning, at the end. But at the end, there are much more than horses. It's a message to Arba Ruchot, and the horns, which are destroyed from the bad nations, from the dangerous nations, but the city is built. That's a political reconstruction. And the scrolls and the sins will fix what was here. So I see an analogy between 2:3 and 3:2 as well. If you read the text, you will see miracles in the text. God returns to Zion and he rescues his people, but invites other nations. If they invite other nations to get there, the horses from Jerusalem in Vision 7 will go out and invite the message of God and judge other nations. And it will not only be the revelation, the Yeshua of Yerushalayim and of the Jewish people, it's going from Jerusalem to the entire world. Following the old Nevi'im at the first temple period, Ki Mitzion Teitze Torah Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. From Zion, there will be an opening for all other nations. That is an amazing message of these Nevuot. And of course, if Zechariah and Haggai and Zechariah bring our part of the 12, they remember who was number one, Hoshea, Yoel, the old ones. They remember and bring them to life in their time. So we have to see everything in a broader context. I could go now, and I decided not to do that. I could go now and compare a lot of messages of these analogies. It needs a lot of reading. It needs a lot of time, and it's enough material for a class of a year to read the 12. But one point I want to highlight here. Give me just a moment, please. And that's here, the message here. Zerubbabel has a special name. And his name, Zerubbabel, is explained. The Jewish people was sent to Babel. Lezarota, expelled. That is chapter, vision 2 and 3. Yoshevet beBavel, bat Babel lezarota. That's the diaspora. But at the end, it says, no, Zerubbabel is a big mountain, and you should come back. And at the end, the name of Zerubbabel is, you will bring all the Jews back from Babel to Eretz Israel. That's an explanation of his name, a fascinating etymology of his names in the vision. And there are many, many interesting analogies which compare it to Haggai, Zechariah, and others, which I recommend those who are interested to learn in more depth I'm happy to communicate there per email on the phone to learn that these units is a menorah. The menorah is the text and the menorah is the message. In the diaspora, they were in the darkness and they go back with the light of Yerushalayim, and that's the light Or Chadash Al Tzion Ta'ir with the menorah, which reminds us is the first temple period. Allow me to show now, and I try not to do that as a rune, but I think it's important to learn what's the message of that. Of course, we understand the first temple period, the second temple period, but we understand now much more. The menorah continued to be the symbol of the Jewish spirit. That's what it says. That's part of the nevuah. And here we have the famous arch of Titus in Rome, which symbolizes the destruction. And you see here the destruction. I'm not sure if we have time to see here. That's the symbol of the destruction. And that was, of course, in the Second Temple period. Allow me to show you here. You can actually find it as well. I prepared it. And I want to show you a short movie, which is a fascinating from Megalim. You can find it online. And I want to show you here the explanation. What's the message of the menorah at the end of the second temple period
in the world? Is amazed at the vast amount of plunder, but the climax arrives when the holy temple vessels are paraded before the masses, including the golden menorah. Behind them, like a prisoner of war, is carried the representative of the Jewish faith, a single Torah scroll from Jerusalem. In the rear are led the prisoners of war themselves. Defeated and disgraced, the POWs from Israel march through the streets of Rome. Their war wounds are well concealed by the embroidered silk garments they're dressed in by the Romans. But nothing can take away the searing pain they bear in their hearts. The crowds cheer Vespasian and Titus as the victory parade makes its way here to the Capitoline Hill. Here, at the Temple of Jupiter Capitolinus, the parade stops, and a hush falls on the crowd. Simon Bar Giora, Jewish commander and spirited leader of the rebellion, is pulled from among the ranks of rebels. With a rope around his neck, he is dragged brutally through the streets of Rome as the wild throng beats him from all sides. The Romans immortalized the conquest of Jerusalem and this parade with a glorious monument situated in the heart of the empire's capital. Exactly where the victory parade passed, Domitian, Titus's brother, built a 15-meter high gate in honor of the great victory. Depicted in the relief on the arch are Roman soldiers crowned with laurel wreaths as they carry the temple vessels, the silver trumpets, the showbread table, and in the center, the temple menorah, painted gold. No wonder the Jews of Rome despised the Arch of Titus. The monument, built 2,000 years ago, served as a painful reminder of the total destruction of Jerusalem and the humiliation of the Jewish people. The sight of the arch seared the Jews' hearts like fire, and for centuries they refused to pass beneath it. Until 1947.
Of the Dutch Committee for Palestine was adopted by certain three votes, 13 against, 10 abstain.
The day after November 29th, the day the UN Assembly declared the establishment of a Jewish state in the land of Israel, the Rabbi of Rome, Rabbi David Prato, convened the Jewish community before the detested arch. The rabbi wished to mark the historic occasion before his community, who gathered by the arch, along with representatives of the youth movements and refugees from the Holocaust, on their way to Israel. Moved to tears, the elderly rabbi who...
So it's worthwhile to see the whole movie, which is not a long one. This idea of Galut diaspora at the menorah, which was the symbol how they came back at the First Temple period, is the symbol after the First Temple period, at the beginning of the Second Temple period, is also the symbol at the destruction of the Second Temple period, and is also the symbol at the return of, in our days, 19, State of Israel. Here is the menorah in front of the Knesset with the artist, and that's the beautiful monument, and that is the beautiful symbol of the State of Israel, not trees of Zeitim of olives, but very similar, which go back to the classical symbol in the Bible in Zechariah. So we saw the summary. Here's the summary. The 12 prophets are one unit of prophecy, but they have a special message. Uvenavi shel shneimasar, as the Gemara says. Haggai and Zechariah are the spiritual leaders, and the spiritual leaders supported the oldest. It's the oldest pre-Hanukkah area. Come back to Eretz Yisrael and celebrate independency, celebrate the Mikdash, and coming back to the light. Zerubbabel and Ben Shealtiel and Yoshua were the post-exilic leaders with the very deep historical sources in Eretz Yisrael. As I said, the second generation and Zechariah's night vision all together are one long night, which come to the end, and the light starts with the menorah. That is wonderfully represented in our day's history. Any easy question? Thank you for your attention. We have a few minutes. Rabbi J.
Thank you. Okay, I just on the screen, I'm not sure I fully follow, but the three lines, you know, as opposed to four, but they show that it's one book. So I assume they didn't really have the scrolls before, but they want to know, what's this like? Did that pre-exist, or that's the halacha sort of made it exist, took something and changed it? I think that's what iPad is asking. But I assume that means when the halacha came, when they started making the Megillot, they did it by three, not by four, right? To show that it's one book.
Correct. So I couldn't actually find it in old manuscripts of the Dead Sea. Might be there are more. Not everything is accessible online. But the idea is, that they are much more connected than all other books, and they are called one book. That's the idea, and that is halacha lemaaseh.